Yeah.
Maybe I just want to. You found a good book here called A Field Guide to Irish Fairies by Bob Curran from 1988. Yeah. Maybe this is kind of an illustrated, you know, book that just has like little brief summaries of all the big Irish fairies, like the different, you know, the different taxonomies. Maybe I'll just read the leprechaun one because it's pretty short.
All right.
There might be some interesting info in here that we don't know already. So he writes that, although the leprechaun has been described as Ireland's national fairy, this name was originally only used in the North Leinster area. In Ulster, the term for this fairy was Lurachmain. In Connaught, Lurachan, and in Munster, Lurgadan. Again, sorry for the pronunciation. Today, the North Leinster name is widely accepted in all parts of Ireland. Leprechauns take the form of aged, diminutive men who usually function as fairy shoemakers. Indeed, the name leprechaun may have derived from the Irish Leithbrogan, shoemaker, although it has been suggested that its origins may be in Luachraman, Irish for pygmy. Interesting. They are frequently to be found in an intoxicated state caused by the consumption of poteen, which they brew themselves. However, they never become so drunk that the hand which holds the hammer becomes unsteady and their work affected. If anything, too much drink makes them even more sullen and argumentative. Female leprechauns do not appear to exist, and there is much speculation as to how these fairies actually reproduce. Leprechauns themselves are extremely secretive about their origins, but it is believed that they may be the offspring of unions between mortals and fairies who have been cast out of their respective worlds. That's a big thing with all these fairies, too, is like they interbreed with like humans for a variety of reasons. So leprechauns carry two leather pouches. In one, there is a silver shilling, a magical coin that returns to the purse each time it is paid out, so that the leprechaun appears to be paying out money without ever actually losing any. In the other, he carries a gold coin, which he uses to try and bribe his way out of difficult situations. This coin usually turns to leaves or ashes once the leprechaun has parted with it. Wow. From this, it may be deduced that the leprechaun can be capricious. He has to be, because in addition to his trade as a cobbler, he is the banker of the fairy world. Wow, I didn't know that. Leprechauns know where large caches of ancient wealth are hidden and have become self-appointed guardians of this wealth. Mm-hmm. Other fairies must go to the leprechaun when they want gold for their revelries or for fairy largesse. The leprechaun's sullen disposition would shame even the most insensitive bank manager. Leprechauns have collected much of the ancient treasure left by the Danes when they marauded through Ireland and had buried it in crocks or pots. The leprechaun has a phenomenal memory and knows the exact location of each crock and can easily recover it if he wishes. However, most leprechauns are natural misers and will not easily part with their money. Leprechauns tend to avoid contact with humans. They do this because they regard them as foolish, flighty creatures, and also because they fear that humans may steal the treasures which they so carefully guard. However, despite their squat and stocky build, the leprechaun is incredibly sprightly and can move quicker than the human eye can see. Most humans only catch a fleeting glimpse as he skips out of their line of vision behind a tree or under a bush. If caught by a mortal, he will promise great wealth if allowed to go free. However, you must never take your eye off him, for he can vanish in an instant, leaving the watcher astonished at his alacrity. So, his sour disposition and natural aversion to humans does not prevent the leprechaun from rewarding those whom he believes have done him a good turn. He has a strong sense of honor and will always return one good deed for another. Unfortunately, such rewards tend to take the form of strong liquor, which invariably leaves the recipient very much the worse for wear. It would appear that the leprechaun family is split into two distinct groups. There is much debate as to whether the cluricaun is actually a type of leprechaun or a degenerate close cousin. Certainly, there is a physical resemblance between the two fairy types, although each has quite a different temperament. The leprechaun is industrious but sullen. The cluricaun is indolent and cheery. While the leprechaun wears green, the cluricaun likes to dress up and wear garish colors. In fact, he sometimes resembles a down-at-heel country gentleman out on a spree. Unlike leprechauns, cluricauns never carry money, nor do they have any knowledge of hidden hoards of gold, usually stealing what they want instead of buying it. Like their wealthier counterparts, they are partial to strong drink and will unashamedly raid the wine cellars and cocktail cabinets of the rich, draining all casks and bottles there. They will also enter larders at night and eat all they can before morning because they have prodigious appetites. For their own amusement, they will create mayhem in a house during the hours of darkness, overturning chairs, breaking plates, or hiding things so they can't be found. Cluricons will also harness sheep, goats, dogs, even domestic fowl, and ride them throughout the country at night. I've heard about this a lot. Fairies love riding horses.
Jinn do that as well.
Oh, yeah. My God.
It's
wow.
One of the oldest, Jinn complaints is them, getting, their hands on, a cow and, making it go crazy.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. The Irish farmer, Pat Noon, who maybe we'll discuss in a little bit. I watched an incredible 1-hour interview with him. I would highly recommend this. Mm-hmm. Of just this Irish farmer / kind of mystical healer guy that is just when I sent you his video, I described it this is SJ's Zizek. he's kind of a little bit of a scruffy, older guy.
Right.
But he's just going off about the fairies and he's so matter of fact and chill about it. But
he emphasized the fairies are normal to him,
they're very normal.
They ask him, he's I don't know what time the train comes into, whatever. It's because that's normal. The fairies are normal. So when they ask my details about the fairies, it's maybe he doesn't know. Cause to him, it's just what's the train schedule?
He's clock pilled. He doesn't pay attention to evil clocks.
Yeah.
He pays attention to the fairies. And he talks about, how he's seen many times at night. I see the horses riding out on the field with the fairies riding on them. And, that's a normal sight.
Fox flying with a, yeah.
Right, oh yeah. Fox flying. Different animals being ridden by fairies is something he sees all the time.
It's all the time
but they might be Cluricons.
There's a sickness in people in Dublin. And
oh, there's
so
definitely
there's
a sickness.
They're
detached
not,
from the nature.
Yeah, so they don't see fairies as much there. But in some places, he does mention, I heard a quote from him, Egypt and that neck of the woods, the Middle East, that they still, they're in touch with the fairies there.
Well, he's not the only one to bring up that apparently this is one of those, deep Irish crypto lore kind of things that, somehow the ancient Egyptians or the Phoenicians, had settlements in Ireland way back in antiquity.
I learned while researching for this episode that James Joyce was all about that.
Wow.
He believed in it super fiercely. A lot of the people around the sort of Irish literary revival, W.B. Yeats had a bunch of weird beliefs. You mentioned he was a theosophist and stuff, or was into theosophy. But James Joyce's big thing was the Phoenician hypothesis of Irish origins, that actually Irish people were descended from Phoenicians who landed in Ireland a long time ago. And he has some quote. Let me see. I have it in my notes here. I just gotta look for. Yeah, he wrote an article called Ireland, Land of Saints and Sages. And in this article, he says this language, that is Irish, is Oriental in origin and has been identified by many philologists with the ancient language of the Phoenicians, the originators of trade and navigation, according to historians. This adventurous people who had a monopoly of the sea established in Ireland a civilization that had decayed and almost disappeared before the first Greek historian took his pen in hand. It jealously preserved the secrets of its knowledge, and the first mention of the island of Ireland in foreign literature is found in a Greek poem of the 5th century before Christ, where the historian repeats the Phoenician tradition. The language of the Latin writer of comedy, Plautus, knew a scholar who worked on exactly what we're talking about now, that there is some Phoenician language preserved in the Plautus play, Poenilus. Joyce argues here that in that play, the language they speak is actually similar to Irish. It's interesting. But there's something in a way to that, because I remember another person, I didn't know him, but I heard of him. I heard of him from someone I studied Coptic with. He was a scholar of Coptic, right? And of Coptic Christianity. And he then did a total career pivot and started to study early insular Irish Christianity, basically.
Huh.
And the Book of Kells and all that stuff.
Oh, the Book of Kells. I wanted to bring that. And the Book of Armagh as well. But
if you look
I've
at
seen the Book of Kells at Trinity College, I think, in Dublin. Yeah, yeah.
I got pissed off Googling the Book of Kells because I saw people were the monks tripping? And it's shut up. Stop trying to force psychedelics on us. Stop trying to attribute every single artistic accomplishment in the history of humanity to psychedelics. Just chill out.
They ate mushrooms.
Yeah, are you kidding me? But the real interesting story there is that there's a clear influence from the Coptic style of art. right? And like the story style of art, like in Oriental Christianity, you know.
I kind of noticed that. I was looking at this folio in the Book of Armagh that's on the Wikipedia page with symbols of the evangelists. And I mean, I could be off base here, but like when I'm looking at these etchings of the evangelists, they kind of do look like Middle Eastern or like almost quasi hieroglyphic.
I think like, people they don't like look... agree that they like there is some clear like link that like we can't quite account for, but like there's some channel of communication between like the, you know, Coptic Christianity or like, you know, the Oriental churches and like the insular churches and the monks who made the Book of Kells.
For access to the full-length episode, subscribe to the Hour of Frequency at patreon.com/subliminaljihad.